Good morning. Welcome to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. There's a lot of news going on, all of it, most of it, bad. We'll be talking about that on the latter half of the show. But we're featuring as our first guest the author, Ray Robertson. And Ray Robertson has a – I'm looking at his photograph – Ray Robertson is the author of 9 novels, 7 collections of nonfiction, and a book of poetry. He's been a finalist for the Hillary Weston Writers Trust Prize for Nonfiction and the Trillium Book Award, and longlisted for the Charles Taylor Prize. Why Not 15 Reasons to Believe was the inspiration for the film 15 Reasons to Believe. His work has been translated into several languages. Born and raised in Chatham, Ontario, he lives in Toronto. And I believe he is with us now. Are you there, Ray?
I am with you, Phil. How are you?
Good. I'm glad to be talking to you. Actually, I thought later in the show, we're going to play a little bit of the song that partly inspired you. Stuck in the Middle.
Yeah, that actually was the original title of the book, was Stuck in the Middle with You.
Well, really?
For a couple of years. And I thought, well, there's no way. No matter what happens with this book, that has to be the title. And then just the way that life works, about a year ago, the Globe and Mail took an excerpt from it for the preface. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, here's this book. I didn't even have a publisher at the time. And they said, okay, great, well, what do you want to call it? And they gave me a title that was kind of lame. And I said, let me walk my dog. I'll come back in 10 minutes. And I came back and said, how about The Right to Be Wrong? And they said, great. And I said, that's actually a better title than mine. So that's how life is. It's just 1 minute. It's all this and then it's something else.
Sometimes a guy listening picks up on an idea that you hadn't thought about.
Right, and which is actually kind of in the book, right? It's like the collaboration, the conversation, the dialogue, you know, and an echo chamber is a really secure, nice place to live, but it's kind of boring, and I think it's less interesting. I think you get, it's a little uncomfortable at times, because who wants to hear, well, we could go this way, but it's actually much better. That fresh air that comes in with other people's opinions is actually, necessary part of the process. Yeah,
that's definitely one of your subversive ideas,
which
is the other guy's opinion might actually have some merit.
It's funny you should say that, because I was talking to somebody, we launched the book last week in Toronto, and someone was saying, how much they liked it, but we were talking all these philosophical things, and I said, there's nothing really in this book that our grandparents didn't believe. It's not that profound, really. It's just, you should be able to have different opinions without yelling or killing. But I guess the times you live in necessitate that you sort of bring these old ideas back into the open. They're not bad ideas. They're just old ideas.
Yeah, well, the book is full of people called Stoics.
Yes.
And they've been around a while.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and
we're only separated from by the language.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's really interesting you should say that, because, like I say, the book's only been out a couple weeks, and sometimes people have said, it's always nice if someone says, I like your book, but some people have been saying, oh, thanks for writing it, because me and my friends have been thinking about this, or we've been talking about this, and no one's kind of saying it. And it's been rewarding that way, just the sense that this radical thought that people should be allowed to talk without hurting each other. It's just interesting how once people see somebody else saying it, it's like, that's true. So that's been kind of rewarding.
Well, there's that other thing, and you bring this to the book, and people say, I'm glad you said that. I've been thinking that for a long time. I mean, you're a little bit like a musician or a poet or something, or maybe a stand-up comedian. You can pick up.
Yes.
Read the crowd, as it were, and you know something is bothering them, and you put your finger on it.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, you've read the book. You know it's a very slim book. It's not like I have any answers to any questions. It's just sort of a conversation starter. And I think that's about as much as someone like me who really doesn't have a clue what's going on in the world can do with a book like this, talking about. And this idea has been with us forever, this idea that please be quiet, because unless you agree with us, Yes. And it goes back, you know, thousands of years. It's not unique. We're not living in unique times. It's just periodically there's this thicket of us and them. And I just think every decade or so, every generation, we need to be reminded that we're not something other than human beings first. We're human beings first, and then we add all these other adjectives on top of us.
Yes.
Yeah. Which, again, isn't that radical, but it's hard when you're kind of in the middle of it. You know, it's hard to see, as you know, when you're from the book, that the first couple, two or three, four drafts of this book were pretty lousy because I was sort of yelling back at the people that I was angry at. And I thought, okay, that's pretty smart, and that's pretty... And then people who read it, including my wife and a couple of friends, said, this doesn't sound like you. The tone wasn't quite right. And I think when you're talking about music or... If the tone isn't right, if it doesn't sound right, you can have all the smart arguments you want. And and I think that was one of the nicest things about a book, especially it's just a little book, is that I honestly think I became a bit of a better person through writing it, through going back to the Stoics and going, oh yeah, this and this. And so for me, it was, you want other people to like it. But first thing is you want to sort of selfishly, did you gain from it? And I really do think I did.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I have to say I think they used to call these chapbooks.
Well, what's that mean?
This is a handy book. You should have it near at hand.
Oh, okay.
And you can take it to work and show it to people.
It's a nice small little book. It's got to get that feel to it.
Without being sanctimonious, it's a kind of a cause book. Sort of like you could give this to someone and say, you and I have had our differences, but
right.
How about reading this? And let's go back to what we were arguing about.
Yeah.
Because it lays out the rules for a sane person.
I'm going to use that as a quote. That's good.
By the way, it's a handsome volume, and whoever did that cover, Pedro, who's a magician and a technician for the show,
right
away said, "Oh man, I like that cover."
Yeah, it's funny because when Cormoran sent me the cover, they emailed it over. My first reaction was, "Oh no!" I mean, it was striking visually, this big sort of X. But I thought, well, the book's about yes. It's about yes. And I said, "Oh, it's giving the wrong message." And I thought, overthinking it. I'm not a visual person. And I thought, no, what you want to do is you want to pick this book up when you see it, then flip it over and see what's that. It's not about exactly. And I like the idea. It's got this big X on it. Sort of like, that's kind of the way I felt for the last 10 years or so.
I liked it because, I recently went to look into some information and a thing came up and it was your cover, except that it said, and it means you've been blocked.
That's right.
So that's your con to get them to open the book.
Yes, I guess that's true.
I don't want
yeah.
you in here, but now that you're here, Well, you tackle really tough subjects, let's talk about the form. This is a very very smart book in my mind because this is actually a long essay. We've been calling it a book.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Book,
yeah,
and you're taking up your lead from a gentleman, he's at the beginning and he's at the end, and he's the father of essays, Montaigne.
Yep. Yes.
Talk about that form and how it seems very appropriate for your topic.
Well, I think
free speech.
He's sort of the guiding spirit. Him and Nietzsche, but I would say Montaigne mostly because Montaigne just always struck me. He's a huge influence on me. I've used him in a couple other books as. But this one, he really was the guiding spirit, this sense of someone who, as you say, invented the essay form, which is, really means literally in English an attempt. And I like that. As opposed to, okay, I've got a thesis and you're... Yeah, my early drafts of this book read too much like an op-ed piece. Like the other side said something I disagree with, so I'm going to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. And then I was right. I said, who the fuck am I to tell people what to think about this? My book's really just about I was frustrated with there was a lack of conversation. And how easy it is to slip into being, okay, everyone, I'm going to tell you how to live now. And Montaigne is the antithesis of that. He's sort of like he embraces this openness to one's own body, to the world around you, to other people. He highlights, he compares the human existence to a wind that we're here. We make you know, we affect others. We do things, but eventually, whoosh, we're gone. And I, not only did I think it was really brave and far-seeing, I just thought it was very humane and very antithetical to our time. And I read Montaigne's essays, and I knew I was going to use them, but I really didn't know as much about Montaigne's time as I did. And I realized that Montaigne, who died at 59, which was actually pretty old for the mid-18th century, he lived for most of his life during a war where his country was at war, and Frenchmen were fighting Frenchmen, and there's a civil war in this country. So if there any time there was an opportunity for one to say, okay, I'm picking my side here, it would be during that time. It's hard to be malleable when people are yelling. And he managed to do that for more than half of his life. His own country was at civil war. And, of course, there was the Catholics versus the Protestants, and there's the good people and the bad people, the whole deal. And I thought, what a tremendous, you know, if Montaigne can do that, perhaps we could do a little better. And he's just such a sane writer. Yeah. And I liked what you said earlier about, you know, the book being, I mean, in many ways, the book's just, not just, but it's partially a repository of all the great things that I've read or heard or in my life that kind of helped me stay sane. Yes. Kind of like a commonplace book in a way. You know, there's a great quote by Simone Veil in there when she talks about if you come to a contradiction and you can't overcome it by anything but a lie, you found a door, and a door for opportunity. And I just wanted to sort of, you know, it's like you're someone you care about. You say, hey, check out this sunset. I just like this quote is very important. And so it was a nice place to gather a lot of those people that have been important to me and sort of, you know, keeping oneself on the ground.
Yeah. Well, you're taking up, of course, we're in a time when we're rather ill-led in terms of talent and people who have any degree of eloquence, which I haven't noticed any, and they've left us with all these electronic toys and these things where we can instantly reach out and bother somebody and insult them. And you take that up in the book. You're trying to explain to people sort of how we fell into this and how we better try to get out of it.
Yeah, I'm not too confident about getting out. you know, I was thinking actually the other day.
Oh, hell.
I write about the Grateful Dead as well. I'm a big Deadhead. And I was rereading this biography of the Dead. And they were talking about how all of the good drugs, you know, marijuana and psychedelics and stuff. And then when cocaine came in 70... 4, 3, 4, and how there was a great quote by a woman who worked in the office, and she said, the strong ones fell very easily. And I feel that way about technology. It's like, you know, I've got a pretty cushy life. I don't have to have a cell phone, you know, but if you've got a job, you need that cell phone. And once you go on that phone and then you check stuff just for work, then you go, oh, okay, I'll check this, I'll check my emails, and then you're in your hour, you're gone. And the scary part to me is that it almost feels addictive. Like I say, I don't use these things much, and yet if I don't check my emails every 35 minutes, I feel something's wrong, an anxiety.
You miss something.
You know?
I'm afraid to go to the bank without my phone. I think, wow, what if something happens?
Exactly. It's, you know, as the kids say, it's systemic. And I'm not sure about getting out, but I am pretty sure about the way that it does facilitate that reactionary thinking that you were talking about. In the sense that all you need to do is read a paragraph online, and then you can post your opinion about some issue.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that that's helpful to any kind of democracy or to one's own personal happiness. You know, that's why at the end of the book I go on and on about, hey, whoop, you still there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I got a beep, sorry. Maybe it's my phone. Just in the sense of... I hope it's not my battery's slow, sorry.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Drive us crazy, I'm sorry. Yeah. I even forget the hell we're talking about. Just in the sense that these thoughts, these issues, they demand more than an instantaneous reaction. They demand meditation, conversation, living with an issue. But that's not sexy. That's not contemporary. That almost is seen as our culture as being apathetic. And that's part of what we're talking about with the book, in the sense that these are old-fashioned values. And maybe just take a minute and think about this or talk about this or let it sit. Go for a dog walk, at least, and then you start posting your opinion on something that's happening halfway across the world away or about in your own community. And I just think that it's kind of a fast-food way of being in the world. And I don't see it changing because the technology and the attitude seems to be about instantaneousness.
Yeah.
You know, and you're almost seen as being a little slow somehow. Like you're not part of the culture, which you're not. Which I don't mind opting out. I mean, it's the tune in, tune out, drop out kind of deal. I don't know how much we can do that, but it seems to me it is a really insidious, and it's very valuable too. That's the dangerous part. Like my mother has terrible rheumatoid arthritis, and so she lives about 4 hours away. So physically seeing her isn't as easy. So we take pictures of our dog or something, and my wife does, and zaps them right off to her on email. Her life's better for it. So it's a technology that can be used to make our lives better. But it's the same thing with any kind of anything else. You can misuse it as well. And I'm just a little worried. It's this tsunami. You know, I read some statistics. I did a Penn event a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking about teenagers spend about 9 minutes a day reading and 6 hours on their phone. And yes. I just don't see how that's going to work in terms of democracy. Or I mean, a vote's fine, but I mean, if you've got someone who doesn't have the capacity to look at two sides of it and think about it, they're just going to listen to whoever the power structure is that says this is the way, that this is good and bad, and this is the way you should be, because there's no way to critically discriminate. And that's kind of terrifying to me.
Yeah. Maybe we should occasionally be stuck on elevators with each other. And
I think so.
And
I remember sometimes you pass by somebody, they'd be standing at a streetcar stop with a paper bag in their pocket. And I thought, if you see that now, I almost feel like one of the people is saying, oh, God bless you for reading. Don't want to be too crazy, but yeah. No, you joke, but that's really true. Silence.
Yeah.
It is such an hard, you don't ever need to be alone anymore. Just put
now,
your earbuds in.
I'm sure you liked the gentleman, Pascal, wasn't it, who said all of our problems stem from our inability to sit still in a room.
That's exactly right.
And I'm working on that.
Yeah, well, me too. It's easier as you get older, too.
By the way, this is Ray Robertson, and the title of the book is The Right to Be Wrong, and it's a handsome volume, Cormorant Press. You got a nice publisher. This is good work. By the way, I'm way into this stuff. I like the typeface. And
it's a nice-looking little book, isn't
and
it?
And I promised myself I wasn't going to mark it, but, heck,
it's
you.
Enthusiastic. And I didn't plan it that way, but it always becomes pretty clear after a couple of months how long a book's going to be. You know, you don't have an idea before you start, of course. But this one I knew pretty early. It wasn't going to be a long book. It was more about, like I say, a conversation starter for one's own dialogue. Hopefully with the book or with others or whatever.
Yeah, your slogan, like Montaigne, is "What do I know?"
Right, exactly.
Which is, by the way, a great trick. When men are angry or women, I have to include. Somebody will say, "What do I know about this?"
Exactly.
And it makes everybody else have to come back to that person,
right?
Because that one said they didn't get it.
Right.
And so now you better explain what you were talking about.
Right. And I also thought that my lack of qualification was one of my qualifications.
Sure.
I am not a good person like you. I am not in the world being involved. I try to hide from the world. I pay my taxes. We give money to the Humane Society. We do all those. But I am not that person. So I thought, even if I'm this person who's got enough privilege in my life that I can hide away from the world, if I'm kind of nauseated by this divisiveness and stuff, what's it like for normal people who have to live in the world and work on these issues and try to make the world a better place? It must be, very difficult. So I thought my lack of interaction with the world was actually kind of an argument for the book, in the sense that even if this clown can't take it anymore, there must be some kind of toxicity out there that needs to be at least highlighted. You know, who knows about doing anything about it? But at least I like the idea, like I said before, that someone would say, we've been talking about this, or I've been thinking about this, so thanks for that. That's really nice.
Yeah. By the way, you had an excerpt from the book in the Globe and Mail. People should read that, because you use humor and laughter.
Right.
And I think that goes all the way back to all of our printed literature, but people haven't noticed that. We seem to have drifted away from it and instead embraced being angry.
Yes.
But you point all these you do not like fundamentalists, because fundamentalists of any stripe already know everything, and they're into using leverage and shutting people up and beating them up, etc. But your point in much of the book is, well, truth is a sort of a cooperative effort. It doesn't hold still. Could you talk about that subject?
Yeah. Well, no, you.
By the way, is Ray Robertson right to be wrong?
You've pretty much said it all for me, Phil. That actually does it all pretty well. No, I think that the fundamentalism idea, and by that I don't mean religious, I don't mean secular, I don't mean left, I don't mean right. This idea that if you say to someone, this always just infuriated me, if there was an issue or a topic, they would consult their left-wing or right-wing handbook to tell you, just a second, I'll tell you my thought on that issue, which seemed to me ridiculous. How can you know what you think about something until you think about it? Well, no, because a good left-winger will say this.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe because of my background, I mean, I studied philosophy and then got smart and started writing novels. Fiction is really messy because I think it's closer to approximation of what reality is like. Reality is, you know, I like that Whitman quote, you know, am I large, I contain multitudes, I'm contradictions, you know. And I think that's who human beings are. And that's not something that you've been allowed to say, that, you know, I'm amorphous, I'm malleable, I don't know every answer on every issue, let me be a part of it. And I think the fundamentalist mindset, and there's obviously an appeal to it.
Yeah.
Because it means you're never in doubt as to what's right and wrong. You also feel strength in numbers.
You say to the person, we're talking about who's right or what's the truth here.
Yeah.
And you're saying, we both want that, right? We're not talking about which of us wins.
Right.
You know, say you run into the street and say, I got him.
Right. Right. But you see, that's a great point because the implication there is that the person who's talking wants to sort of come to a better understanding. I find very often it is. This is why I go warily near the topic of politics. Politics is about power. Those who have it trying to hold on to it. Those who don't have it trying to get it. So very often your argument is not about a disinterested search for the truth. It's not. It's really about how can I get my way? Because you are in error. You will have a better life if you do and think what we think. So we're doing this for your good. And I actually, you know, I believe in good causes, and that kind of does make sense in a way. But I also know some horrible, horrible people have thought that and do think that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somehow if we turn the Middle East into a Las Vegas, you know, it'll be a good thing for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, you can disagree with that. But going back to your conversation,
I'm against
humor,
gambling.
Yeah. About humor, I'm glad you put anything that was in the Globe essay is in the book. But what was nice about talking about humor was it really is it's really an insidious tool. You can talk about things using humor that you can't if you decided to just be a straightforward, you know, narrative. Because somehow, particularly in our kind of Puritan culture, humor isn't seen as serious. It almost seems like, okay, here's a serious enough, now we'll sprinkle some humor on it.
Yeah.
Whereas you were saying earlier, all great literature, all great writing, yeah, even Nietzsche, you know, there's humor, there's irony, there's something besides the straightforward declarative sentence, which I will speak loudly at you.
Well, wasn't it Nietzsche who said that if it's boring, it's not true?
Yeah. That's right. And he talks about his God. His God is a dancing God. And he uses that metaphor of dance. And I love that metaphor.
Yeah, that's your killer clothes. I don't like to give it away, but that's a lovely clothes on your
essay. Fundamentalists don't dance for the shit. Yeah, exactly.
I'll meet you on the dance floor.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
It's a keeping oneself open. I mean, also, if you live long enough, too, and this is really hard when, you know, you're talking to someone who's 20 and has all the best ambition in the world to make the world a better place, it's very important to be kind of fundamentalist because you embrace that point of view, and it might even be the right point of view. But when you get older, you see, geez, your mind does change, you know? I didn't listen to jazz for a long, long time. Just thought it was just not for me. And then I got into the Dead and through Garcia's guitar. And now I can't imagine my life without jazz. And that would have been impossible for me to imagine 15 years ago. Now, does that mean I was right back then, or I'm right now? I think it's just part of this journey, and I didn't have I didn't have the ears big enough. I didn't have the point of view. I couldn't see it.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's part of my journey, my growth, or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, I'm glad that my mind changed or that the situation changed.
Yeah.
Like I said, the echo.
I hope you were thinking in the back of your mind, I might be wrong about this.
Yeah.
maybe I should give up cowboy music.
Yeah.
And,
it wasn't that, but I remember.
Sell the horse.
Yeah, yes, yes. But that malleability I find more and more attractive. And I think that it's taken me a long time to sort of be. I think of this book as being comfortable with the uncomfortable. You know, yeah. You talk about that with sports and as a metaphor. I think it's a good metaphor. If we're constantly going looking for solace or solidarity, I see the point of that in particular cases, but in terms of a life view, I just think it's a less interesting life, as well as being kind of literate politically. I just think it's kind of less interesting to know everything. You know, it's reassuring, but it's just not as interesting a life to be open to experiment and to exposure to new things, or sometimes a fusion of different things.
And to accomplish that, you got to go with Mr. First Amendment, Mikkel Jahn, and say,
right.
I don't agree with him, but leave him alone.
Right. And
I'll come back. Maybe I'll find that he's making sense anyhow.
Yeah. Or this could often be, you know what, I don't agree, but at least I told myself I've done my due diligence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the essence of this is just two sides, like left and right. You know, and I don't mean a mushy middle ground of compromise. I mean a middle, like, you know what, there's probably, like, understand where these people who you disagree with are coming from in terms of why they're acting this way. They mm-hmm. may not be right, but why are they acting this way?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you don't know that when you talk to them because they're yelling at you. So my reaction is always to yell back, and that's very human. I think it's very part of our DNA.
Well, you know, by the way, isn't it probably the Bible, that soft words turn away wrath?
Well, that's great. I wish I'd used that in the book.
I found that it actually works. Actually, by the way, I'm a smallish individual, and I've given up fighting. So I've tried this stuff. It does. I'm kind of proud of myself when I do not go, you know, start hopping and yelling.
Right.
But just say, another way to disarm them is to say, you might be right.
Right.
Let me think about that.
Right. Yeah, it was always considered good to say, yes, but on the other hand, or something like that.
Yeah.
And also, too, you know, not to be too idealistic, there are some people who don't want to have that dance with you. They don't want to have the dog. They want you to stop talking. So, you know, they look away while you're talking. Now I can tell you my point of view. Well, Marcus Aurelius talks about that, one of our Stoic friends. He just says, okay, you just say, I'll walk away then. Because, you
Why
know,
not?
Arguing with a fundamentalist sometimes is, it just bounces back at you. But if you do find that individual, that dance, it takes two to dance, right?
Yeah. But that's that part of that dance idea. You're up close, and a guy becomes a little too close, and you say, I'm going to go dance somewhere else.
Yeah. that's a perfect metaphor. I wish we had this conversation before I'd written the book. This is good. That's exactly it. And it doesn't mean that you're closing the door, but I just liked it because it injected a bit of realism in the sense that, in this perfect world, we'll have this open dialogue. Well, you're not gonna argue with a Trump supporter, you know,
no.
for the most part.
Yeah. It's the old expression we used to use. It just say later.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That could have been the title of the book. Later. Exactly. But at least you've sort of said, look, I was open to it, you know. And I do think that, you know, that old cliche, you know, be the change. I think if more of us were like later, I think it might cool things down a bit.
Yeah.
unless your whole point is to, you know, we have this truth, and my goal is to make it happen. So I'll use all those tools,
mm-hmm.
you know, political tools, or like you said. But if you're talking about that, yeah, I think that's a really good point.
Yeah.
It's not often you meet somebody who's interested in sort of going deeper into something.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually about, okay, I'll just wait till you're done talking, then I'll tell you the truth. which, again, and this is why, for such a short book, there is a portion of the book that is about how I did that a lot in my early drafts, and how easy it is, you know, I talk about sports too, how easy sports are. Great, because you say, this is the good team, I'm going to cheer for them. This is the bad team, I boo against them.
Yes.
And it's harmless, you know, a whole city gets, woo, go Blue Jays, you know, it's very great. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. And it's kind of dangerous in a way that you're taking pride in something you had nothing to do with. But, you know, God bless, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But when you transfer that to talking about politics or morality or even aesthetics or metaphysics, whatever, I think that's the problem. I think sports is a wonderful kind of like way to sort of exercise that part of our lizard brain that sort of says, "Me, our team good, your team bad," you know? Yeah. And it's fun. I mean, my mother doesn't watch, you know, luge or speed skating unless it's the Olympics and she can cheer for Canada.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's ridiculous. She has no interest in the sport, but she's interested in, the women got a second place. I feel so good, you know? Okay, that's part of who we are.
Yeah.
But then acknowledging that maybe that's not the way for adults to act in the House of Commons, or maybe it's not the way for pundits and newspapers to act, or, you know, maybe they're two different things.
Yeah. Again, by the way, this is Ray Robertson, and the book is Right to Be Wrong. It is Cormorant Press. It's freshly out. What a great cover. And the thing of going back to Montaigne and experience. Strangely enough, the mention of your mother and sport. He had the thing about experience. I don't know if you. I have this fan thing that I like to see these guys.
Yeah.
For example, you, any writer, I read the book and I say, okay, so what's, you know, the oldest question? What's he really like? What we want is that experience.
Yes.
Because we know we can be conned.
Yes.
You know, that somebody can do something really flashy and then you find out he's a jerk. And I had the experience of leaping over a fence and chasing an Olympic champion, and he wouldn't give me an autograph because he was an Olympic champion. So I went over to the guy who was finished second, and he was a warm, sweet guy, and I had not been for him, but from that day forward. But that was experience.
Yes, and that's actually one of Montaigne's essays called On Experience. Yeah, and the best, you know, a great metaphor I heard for this once is the writer William Gass, and he was talking about the importance, and that's why I talk a lot about Flannery O'Connor in the book and her idea of good writing. It show, taste, smell, all the particulars. And he was saying that the essence of that is, if you hadn't seen a friend in a while, and they say, "What's going on?" You say, "Oh, I'm seeing somebody. I got to know. Oh, interesting. You know, what's she or he like?" And you'd hand them a resume, and the person would say, "That's ridiculous. I'd rather meet them."
Absolutely.
Find out what their sense of humor is, what they're really not.
2 minutes. Give me 2 minutes.
But instead, it's like, no, here's the information. The information is not the reality. Reality needs to be experienced.
Yes.
And that's the case so often when with so many of these issues, you know, people sort of living in sort of a bubble and saying, I think it should be this way. Well, have you been in the situation of someone? Well, no, but, you know, from my perspective, reading the paper today, having my cup of coffee, I've decided I feel this way about the issue. You know, I just don't, and then it makes me sound like a bit of a snob or something, but I don't have time to be in that world of that whirlwind of opinions.
Yeah.
I need someone who's actually going to get down with the situation and get inside of it and probably get lost in it, so they kind of lose their one side or the other side-ness, and maybe come out with the same opinion.
Yeah.
But at least the same opinion with
respect.
yeah, exactly.
And
I think that makes one more comfortable. I mean, doesn't it sound like people have too much difficulty with whipping off opinions? But for me, am I going to sort of take a quote-unquote stand on something? I do want to immerse myself in it, which is why I often don't, because I'm far too lazy. You know, it's like, I got to understand both sides. Okay, I'll leave that to the grown-ups. But if I do, and this isn't just political things, right? It's in terms of personal things, you know, art. I don't think you understand, you know, did you like the book? Well, I just finished an 800-page book. Give me some time. Or, you know, sometimes I only really, really love to love a movie until I see it two or three times. Then it becomes a favorite. First time, didn't really understand the language. It was a bit...
Yes.
It was English, but I mean, aesthetically.
Yeah, you were ripe for the book. The book wasn't ripe for you, or vice versa.
I don't know if you've had this experience. I thought that about... The Big Lebowski was one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
But the first time I saw it, I was a fan of the Coen brothers, and I didn't like it because there's two or three places where it's a little self-indulgent. I thought, this is terrible. And then one night, my wife was away, and I was just flipping, and I came across it was on TV, and I just thought, this is hilarious. I've got to watch this movie again. And now I know all the dialogue. Does that mean I was right before? No, I wasn't ready for it. It wasn't ready for me. And maybe that's the case with certain ideas. You know, as I'm not saying I agree with them, but Churchill said that anyone who's not a revolutionary when they were young is a coward.
Yeah.
Anyone who's not a conservative when they're old is a fool.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's true, but I like the idea that we're not just these rational beings that have this pre-programmed set of opinions.
Yes.
And it's a journey. It's messy. And this is why I say I come back to my day job is to write novels, is that you really, I mean, I'm a much inferior person to the characters in my books, not because they're noble beings, but because they're a little bit of everything. Whereas you go in the world, you kind of have to have an identity, your Facebook face, you know, your Instagram face, yeah. Which isn't reality.
Yeah.
Your reality is very, very, very messy. And I think fiction in good art, movies, film, whatever,
yeah,
teaches us that. And I, instead of sort of recoiling from it and saying, no, no, we are, I'm a card-carrying member of whatever,
yeah,
it's scary, but I think it also can be kind of exciting and kind of like, you know, I could be, when you're a kid and you go into a bookstore, a record store, you think, my life could change today. I could find, like, the author. She could just, you know, this person could just, and it's that excitement, which, you know, dissipates as you get older, but I still think there's that element to it that, yeah, yes, the world is an opportunity to engage with, as opposed to how does it fit into my schema,
yeah,
of a reality.
Clancy Siegel has a great line. He was a title of an essay. He said, my karma ran over my dogma.
Yeah, I like that.
That's sort of the dude, you know.
Yes, that's very dude. I mean, that's very dude. Yeah. It reminds me of the old boxing axiom. You know, everybody has a plan until they get hit. You know, you sort of like, okay, I got it all figured out, and pop. So how do you respond?
Yeah.
And that's something I was aware of when I was writing the book, and why I don't have any answers. I don't know. It's the same thing with free speech. How far do we go? I'm just pointing these things out. I don't have any answers, but I do feel, you know, like you were saying, that these things really do, they're unpredictable. I think that's kind of the scary part, but kind of the exciting part, that we could change.
That's back to Montaigne. You say, what do I know? You're trying,
right.
You're engaging. Well, actually, Napoleon said that about war, right? He said, on s'engage puis on voit. I don't speak French, but it means first we engage and then we'll find out.
Yeah, and it's the antithesis now, right?
I mean, looks tough. Maybe he's not. Hit him, Switzer.
Right. But isn't that sort of like, I'll go in with the opinions I'm supposed to have, and then I'll find out, as opposed to the other. But it's not going to happen unless you sort of have a certain humility. And I think, going back to what you were saying before, I think a sense of humor.
Yeah.
I don't think that these, I don't, I, well, my, Nietzsche talks, he said, I don't trust anyone who doesn't have a sense of humor. And I think you think about that. And Kundera talked about that when he was living in then Czechoslovakia, and there would be Russian agents because they were in the artistic circles and all these wacky bohemians. And
said you could spot the spies because
they
had no sense of humor.
They didn't have a sense of humor. They were ideologues.
Yeah.
And
if they weren't spies, who wants those guys around?
Exactly. You know, it's almost like I'd almost rather have someone I disagree with who has certain a certain zest and interest, as opposed to someone, yeah, actually, I agree with everything he says. But what a bore, because he learned these things from a book somewhere or from his friends who said, oh, no, if you want to be...
They're checking the boxes.
Good progressive, you have to think this.
Yeah, they're not talking, they're just checking the boxes.
He's checking the boxes, right. And
there's those, here comes him again.
And you think about the great people, I keep coming back to the Grateful Dead this morning for some reason, but the reason early on, not later, but early on why I was so transformed by their music, other than Garcia's genius on guitar, was this openness. Like, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. Anything could happen at a show. And, now, of course, that changes as the money changes. And becomes more. But early on, I found that just so intoxicating, that the whole process of performance. You know, Bob Weir famously said, you know, some of those great early shows at the Fillmore, this ain't a show, it's a party. You know, it's a hand-me-down from the acid test. In a sense, it's participatory. There isn't an audience versus performers. We're all kind of doing this. That's kind of idealistic, and it changes. Mm-hmm. But I really like the idea of terms of community that way, in the sense that there really isn't the priest caste up here as the rest of us, whether that be politicians or pundits. We're all just part of this confusing soup. And that's why I think democracy is. I don't think democracy is anything more than a bunch of people who tacitly agree, and we don't all have the answers individually. So let's pool our talents and maybe muck through this and come out of it not perfect but better. It's the people who want perfection, the ones who say okay you and this is how
you want to be safe. Who's going to make us safe?
Yes, make us safe. It's authority figures. I mean, Trump didn't happen because some bad people came out of nowhere. There was a need for this somewhere. And these people who think
fear.
That, you know, and that's people on the right or left. I understand. They don't want to think about these people as real people. They want to think of them as these
yes.
ignorant and as, you know, true to a degree. But
yes.
where does this come from?
Yes.
You know, my parents, neither of my parents went to high school. They were working full-time jobs at the age of 14. They voted NDP their whole lives till eventually they didn't know what the NDP was. So they vote liberal.
Yeah.
They're working people who were driven away from the NDP
yeah.
because they were like, Ray, what's a colonialist? What have I done? I'm like, Mom, I don't know. You're an immigrant, too. I don't understand. But you're a white person. You're a bad person. You know, and that's a crime because they're good working class people.
Yeah.
And they don't understand the grad school talk of a lot of the NDP. Not all. Of
all
course,
language
have
is definitely.
I have friends who are NDP people.
Language.
But I'm just saying, and when it becomes to grad school, I think we've lost the plot. And
yes.
again, that kind of openness, I think, is really, really
you know, they didn't. People don't like being preached to.
Right.
You
even
know,
if they're
we
right.
ought to challenge people who are going to say, well, you know, we should all do this. I would say, if you can say that and make it funny, I'll vote for you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But it doesn't, because humor allows you to sort of like poke around and go, yeah, on the other hand, this kind of thing. Humor
yeah.
has that built-in irony to it. That's very yes. dangerous to someone who wants you not to think about a specific anything outside, you know, like the horse with the blinders. And
yes.
I think that's the beauty of humor. It's not just like, oh, it alleviates the tension. It'll actually allow you to see both sides of things sometimes. Not that it means that you're going to change, but you can go, okay, well, I can see what these people are scared of. And I can
yeah.
see why they'd elect this lunatic because, you know, why are they scared?
Yes.
Well, we don't want to think about that. The important thing is there's a rally today against it. And I get that. Maybe that's my role, to sort of be on the sidelines and say,
well, you have a right to be on the sidelines. You,
yeah.
The right to be
always,
wrong,
yeah,
Ray
yeah.
Robertson, is an argument for, hey, I don't even have to attend.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just the last 10 years or so, it's been hard to, no matter how big my moat is, stuff keeps getting thrown over. So I had to throw something back. So I think this book is what I'm throwing back, because that's about the best I can do as a writer.
Yeah. Well, there's three great names there. Marcus Aurelius. It compliments Montaigne very
yes.
nicely in
yes,
your book.
Yes, they do.
It is a little depressing to realize that Bill Clinton has, he says it, Aurelius by his bedside. It didn't seem to help him much, but it will help you.
I think so. And isn't that one of the things that's antithetical to our time that's so great? You put a copy of Montaigne, I prefer the Donald Frame translation. I don't speak French, and it's not the newest, but I like it a lot. And you put it beside you, and you leaf through it. And the best definition of art or literature I ever heard was from Rebecca West. And she said, you know, you hear all these great philosophical definitions. She said, good literature is companionship. And I pick up Montaigne and I feel a little less alone, a little less like, oh, this world. And that gives me more comfort and gives me a chance to recharge and come back
yeah.
the next day. And
yes.
isn't that really what art is? It's you know, sure, it's entertaining. He's got a great voice.
Yes.
I mean, I wouldn't read any author unless their voice
yeah.
is appealing.
Yes.
But I do feel like everything is predicated upon the newest tweet. And going back to these ancient books, to me, is just not valued in our culture. You know, a cup of coffee costs $5. You can pick up a copy of Montaigne on Bloor Street on the way home for
yeah.
$5.
Well, alongside The Right to Be Wrong by Ray Robertson.
Or that one, right.
The annotated version of Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah. Well, if my book's no good, at least there's some good writers inside it. So that's the thing.
Isn't it great? You lock yourself in time with a kindred spirit from 2,000-3,000 years ago, and there you are talking about the same thing?
Yes, and our shared humanity.
Yeah.
You know, and that was
what's
kind of cool about this book. I've had people, different genders, different sexualities, say to me, you know, thanks for writing the book. And it wasn't because you stuck up for our point of view. The only people I've had any trouble with, when the book first, we're getting ready to promote it, we thought, well, some of these kind of like small-c conservative kind of websites and blogs, they're constantly bemoaning the lack of dialogue. The left obviously dominates these things, blah, blah. So I said, great, you know, we can use their platform to promote our book. So we sent the book off, and they're like, oh, wow, this sounds great. And then they saw that I said bad things about the right. Cricket
yeah.
since then.
Yeah.
They were interested in free speech as long as I was criticizing the left.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, he's not one of us? Get rid of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They thought,
how
okay,
did he get in here?
Yeah, they thought,
well, he said what you said.
Yes.
But he later he didn't say what you said, so
right. yes.
we're going to have to burn him.
They thought, he's an anti-woke guy. We'll get him on. And I said, well, there's some really scary shit that happened. But there's also scary shit. It's scary everywhere. Oh, no, it's nice and safe over on our side. And so it's really interesting. So the people who have responded have been kind of, well, stuck in the middle, I guess.
Yeah, stuck in the middle.
Extreme left, extreme right. They're each other's oxygen and spur. And I understand they certain attraction to certain people. But for most people, it is a little alienating. And how sad is that, you know? But maybe that's good. Maybe floating in the middle is what we need, you know? Float, like you said, later.
Well, just
later while I float.
Yeah, to be comfortable with your discomfort.
Yes, which is
By the way, and Nietzsche and others in the book, you cite them. But, of course, by the way, your prose is very accessible, very smooth. It's like a nice wine, you know?
Good. Well, I'm hoping it's a voice, you know? Like my goal is always, even if someone doesn't like my stuff, they'll say, oh, that's a Robertson book. It sounds like him, which is fine. Other people sound like other people, but that's nice to hear that it resonated, especially a book like this. You know, it can't be.
You'll tell some very, you have a lot of sobering lines, but then you smile at the end, which is, and leaving the reader to think, I guess I better smile too.
That's beautiful, man. That's exactly it. Because that's why I think we need humor, is because if you're going to get into the dark, deep stuff, you better have a sense of humor. Otherwise, it'll be superficial. It'll sound like
it'll drive you crazy.
Right. It'll sound like a politician or a pundit, where all issues have been discussed. You know, no, this is really kind of calamitous stuff, and it's kind of scary. And so we better joke about it, because, you know, humor is usually the last thing to go when someone is, like, clinically depressed. Many years ago, I had a clinical depression.
Yeah. And well, people commented. I read the comments in the Globe on your the excerpt, and there were a number that said, well, I really like this, but, you know, there's a point there. We don't have humor columns anymore.
Right.
It's like we can't handle humor,
I guess. That's right. That's right. Well, because humor means you're not serious, and these are serious times, which to me is ridiculous.
Yeah. You might be making fun of somebody who'll smack you.
Yeah. And you know, like, it's not like you can't have Shakespeare without humor. And not just to throw in some funny lines to relieve things, but because tragedy and humor, you know, Nabokov said famously that the only difference between comic and cosmic is the letter S, in the sense that the big picture, it is kind of a great cosmic riddle, and there's humor with that. And it's the solemn people, it's the straight-faced, politico straight, they scare me.
Yeah.
They really do. They really scare me, because there's nothing but their point of view. And one of the most haunting quotes for me in the book is from Eva Braun. You remember the quote where Hitler and the Soviets are literally 1,000 meters from the door of the bunker, and she managed to sneak out a letter to her sister. And she said, "It's hard to believe this could be happening. It's enough to make one question God." And I don't believe she wasn't insincere. I believe she was very sincere.
Oh, no, she absolutely believed that.
And I know you said, well, I'm not a
And
Nazi.
Everybody
I
should
love,
take
okay,
that as
not.
A cautionary tale. Is,
yeah.
Can you believe it? This is what Eva Braun actually thought.
Right, and I think that's ultimately what it is. My book's not about those bad people who think that. It's about us and how we have the capacity to be that way. And not only shouldn't we do it for society, we should do it because it's a less interesting life. But it's in us. It's not them.
Yeah.
You know, and no matter what your party credentials are, and you still got that ugly little part of us. And maybe just being aware of it makes it a little less pronounced. That's maybe the best we can hope for.
Well, this is I'll use the word chapbook again. Everybody should have this at hand to calm down. And if not calm down, at least get a good laugh.
And some red wine, too, though.
Yes, and really finely written, The Right to Be Wrong, Ray Robertson. And a great picture. You're wearing a ball cap with no slogan on it.
Nice
slogans, going.
exactly.
Ray Robertson, it's been a pleasure.
I love it, Phil.
Talking to you. Let's do it again sometime.
You'll stay in touch. I appreciate it, Phil. Thanks.
Comrade Books, thank you. Okay. Bye-bye. That was Ray Robinson. Robertson, I actually have to tell him something. We once interviewed him at CIUT, I swear, on St. George Street, and I couldn't resist telling him that talking to him made me think of Sugar Ray Robertson. And the two names are locked together in my head. You know how you have a name and you can't, and it's stuck to another guy? Hey, we have that song, Stuck in the Middle, and Pedro's going to play that right now.
All right, here we go.